Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains May 2nd through the 12th. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Hey guys, it's Al. We got a great show for you this week. We're going to kick things off by getting into all the news with Gresh. Then we're going to give you an inside look into how 2020 has turned the scouting process upside down by somebody who knows all of the ins and outs of it. And as always, we wrap things up with all of your questions in six-pack. Let's go. All right, welcome in. I'm back in the home office. I am sorry for the delay. This week we had a little, I guess, some travel issues isn't the right way to put it, but just kind of work and travel piling up, and 7 o'clock flight last night back from Florida to Massachusetts. Bottom line, you're getting in a little later. We're going to try to make it that much better for you this week. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, and we are bringing our friend Andy Gresh back in for the takeaways. And Gresh, I'm fresh off of 7 training camps. I went and saw the Patriots, Jets, Giants, Eagles, Ravens, Bucks, and Dolphins. And I got to tell you, it was good to see actual football practice again. And once you got through the door, it was relatively normal. But man, like, you look at the outside of these facilities, you look what, I mean, you can see the machine at work.
Well, I think they've sort of trying to build their own bubbles, right? Like, yeah. I know that people joked around with Jerry Jones and the Cowboys for basically kind of admitting that. But it's funny you mentioned the old outside of the facilities, to where normally there's hustling, there's bustling, there's fans, there's people eavesdropping. Like, we know in the part of the world that we live in New England, normally when they would open up that fence, which is like the side gate over at Gillette, there'd be some kid's face pressed up against the front of it because some, you know, guy who hawks memorabilia wanted him there to get Tom Brady's signature on a football at one point in time. And there's no buzz. And Bert, on my national radio show on CBS Sports Radio, I asked people, are you missing preseason football now? Because everybody hated it. And now that you don't have it, it's like, oh, maybe it wasn't so bad after all. Because you can feel detached from your local football team because the coverage is different. You can't go to practice. There's no preseason games. It's like a whole
buzz.
Yeah, the buzz is very odd.
Right. And so, like, I'm excited for football. I'm really excited to see what it looks like. You know, you do wonder, and there's part of me that wonders if the NFL is making a mistake. And look, I'm not the big, we need access, guys. Like, I've always kind of sort of taken the attitude, I'll make my own access, right? Like, but, you know, the one thing I thought about when you saw some of the complaining about, like, the practice rules, right? Like, you can't report X, Y, and Z about what's going on the field. Sort of started to think about it. I'm like, if I'm the league, I'm a little concerned about the lack of buzz, right? If I'm the teams, I'm a little concerned about the lack of buzz. I'm not talking about the football people. I'm talking about, like, the business side people, right? And then I'm looking at, like, some of the ratings in the other sports, which have been scattershot. Like, some of them are up, but I think most of them are down, right? And I think that that's because you turn on the TV and it's great to have it back, but maybe it's a little hard to engage with a product that you're not, that doesn't look quite like you're used to seeing it. And so if I'm the NFL, I sort of look at this, and maybe I don't know, for the last week and a half of camp, I tell the teams to loosen up the rules about reporting stuff, because so much of it is like, it's like the stuff that you talk about, stuff we're going to talk about here, some of the stuff we're going to talk about here, just kind of the drama that goes into the summer and position battles and who's going to play here and what does this rookie quarterback look like there. And I just feel like because they've choked off some of, like, what can be reported at training camp, and then the fans aren't there, and then you don't have preseason games, they've sort of like killed a lot of the discussion around their sport.
Well, look, unless I'm stepping out of bounds here and blaming the wrong guy, this is one of those where we can tie it back to Bill Belichick. Because, but you know, they were among the first, I do believe, to sort of put the mandate on people of, you know, don't report things you see at camp. I mean, I remember doing radio in Boston in 2014 and catching flack for talking about Darrell Revis and Gronk working in a goal line situation. And that was on a radio show and I saw it. So, I mean, you know, now we've gotten to the point to where NFL teams, they don't want to just try to control their narrative. They want to try to shape your narrative. And the easy way to do that is to, you know, look at the setup. Now, the setup we have right now is necessary because people can't be around each other because of COVID-19. But I think I might know a little bit of the road you're going down here in that we may never return, like for the guys like Bill Belichick and the coaches who don't want you anywhere near the players or talking to anyone,
knowing that
they can control it for 15 minutes a week on Zoom with a lot of players. Not only does it hamstring the ability to get information, but from a coaching standpoint, that means that stuff can't get out.
And that's definitely an issue. I think the other thing, and look, like when you saw Darrell Revis covering Gronk in a goal line drill, so did 15,000 other people that were sitting on the hill, you know? And so, like, I think that was why they were looser about it in the past. And all of this goes back to, like, the way coaches think, right? Like, which is, if there are 15,000 people there or 10,000 in Green Bay or whatever the number is wherever, you know, I think probably most coaches can look at it logically and say, that's going to get up on some fan blog anyway. So go nuts. You know what I mean? Like,
I played college football from 92 to 95, and my coach once had us to psych out another team because he was convinced they had come into our stadium and were watching our walkthrough. This is how crazy this person was, that we dressed like ragamuffins so that we convinced them that we were all a bunch of bums and we had a better chance to win. Of course, we went out, got our ass kicked like 38-3 or something like that against William and Mary. But these are borderline. And I say this, these are borderline people who get in their head so much that they psych themselves out in situations like
this. So my high school coach, who I love and adore and who made a huge impact in my life, he had us wear blank yellow practice. Now, LS, like Lincoln Sudbury isn't a, it's not a, like we're not hurting for money, right? So blank yellow practice jerseys. And then if you made starting defense, then you got a black one, right? Like, so it's black shirts, which goes back to, like, we had a couple kids in the 80s who went to Nebraska. One of them became the fourth overall pick in the draft. Nebraska's the black shirts on defense. So if you were a starting defensive player, you wore a black shirt in practice. So we wore those in practice. No numbers, no markings. Didn't even say Lincoln Sudbury on them. And we wore those in the scrimmages too, because the coaches knew that other coaches were coming to the scrimmages. And they didn't want anyone to know who anybody was. And so, you know, it's just, it's, that's like, I guess that's an endemic to football coaches, right? It's just I just think in this situation, like what I'm saying is that, you know, a lot of the conversation this time of year is driven by that stuff, you know, and you're just not getting as much of it. But we'll try to give you some of it here. We're going to get into the takeaways now. My first takeaway is non-football, but is going to relate to whether or not we can play football in the fall. And that's just, I mean, the continued outstanding numbers that we're seeing from a COVID perspective. And I don't think this summer could have gone much better for the NFL, knock on wood. Right now, there are 2,600 players in camps, three total in the NFL are on the COVID-19 list, which is, I mean, I don't know that like the most optimistic owner would have guessed that, right?
It's like, shocking. Let's be real. It's a shocking number based on the way our minds have been programmed with COVID and what has happened in other sports.
Right. So you have that, right? So yeah. And then over the weekend, we had this spike in positives, right? But they were all false. And I even think that was a good thing because now they got to kind of, it was like a real life. It was like a fire drill that you thought was real life, right? Like this is a fire drill, only you didn't know that it was fake. So all these teams had to go into this mode, 11 of them, where they were dealing with positives in their building on like what they could very easily conjure up as a game day. Because you think about it, right? Those tests went in on Saturday. right? They got the results back on Sunday morning, 3 weeks before the opener. And so they had to deal, one team, the Buffalo Bills, had to deal with the idea that their starting quarterback was going to be gone. And so they had to adjust. They had to kind of put contingency plans into motion, all that stuff. So they got a chance to look at that. They're going to be able to adjust some of the protocols to work with that. I think maybe they'll, you know, figure out a way where in an emergency they can rerun a test. The rapid tests are getting a little bit more reliable. But the bottom line is, Gresh, like, and I've been at seven of these camps this week, like, this is working. Like, this is, and granted, there are going to be some more variables thrown in the mix. People's kids, coaches, players, kids are going to go back to school. So obviously that's going to be a new piece of the environment. You're going to have in certain places, you're going to have, you know, the hours are going to change. And so players and coaches are going to be over the next few weeks in the building a little bit less. So there's a little less control there. I mean, what happens when a team starts out 2-6? There are some fair questions to be asked there. But I think to this point, everything's been, I think, has gone as smoothly as anybody could have possibly hoped.
Now, I think because we hear that they're not in a bubble, you almost expect the worst, that right, someone's going to step on their tail somewhere along the way and you're going to end up having a problem. And I still think that risk is very real because we're not at the point to where, A, we have the final rosters yet. Mm-hmm. B, once we start having guys getting injured, there are going to be people coming in and out of buildings, and that's going to add a layer of complexity. And I'm talking about guys coming in on the Tuesday tryout and then maybe getting added to the roster the next day because of injury. So there are still a lot of hoops to jump through. But, Bert, my real hope is that I've always known that when it comes down to it, and when you throw in the looming specter of non-guaranteed contracts for a lot of these guys, they need to follow the protocols. They need to work. They need the money. We've talked about that a lot over the years with these NFL players. And I'm hoping that the discipline the players can show when they're on the field is something that they can continue once they're away from the facility. And I would dare say there are two things at work here, Bert, that really help in terms of holding players accountable. Number one, other players.
That part's huge. Like, hearing it from another player is different than hearing it from a coach.
Because every locker room has their Debo. I don't care who you are, from the movie Friday. My mama gave me that chain. Like, walk in the room and rip it off your neck. Like, that kind of are the kind of people that they're going to be running the locker room. And here's the other one, too, and we've seen this in Major League Baseball, and this is what NFL teams should adopt. If you go out and do something stupid and break the protocol, you got to do the old Zoom with rubes like me and you, and you're going to be held accountable for what you did. Major League Baseball had an example in Zach Plesac where he didn't give a great explanation. And then they get these dudes on Zoom and they're like, hey, why were you an idiot? So it's almost like there's a layer of public accountability as well if you're one of these people that they have to contact, trace, and figure out how you got COVID.
No question. And so, like, again, like, we don't know what this is going to look like, but I, you know, my big takeaway, I'm happy to see people trying to find pragmatic solutions and at the same being careful, but not being like not being completely defeatist about this thing, you know. And
you can't be scared of it.
It's interesting.
We all have to realize how to manage.
You've met my buddy Ron. My buddy Ron is he's a high school football coach down in Florida. He's in sales now, but when I was down in Tampa, I went and visited him and his family, and I was telling him about like what it's like at the different camps, and then he mentioned, oh, I've been watching Hard Knocks, so I've seen some of it. So I said, what do you think? And he said to me, he said, looks to me like the NFL should be running the country. And
let's not go that far, good Lord.
But I thought it was interesting because it was like, yeah, because like they're looking for, they're neither on the side of open it all up or shut it all down. They're on neither side. They're like they're squarely sitting there and saying, we can't like act like a bunch of like drunk cowboys here, right? At the same time, we can't lock ourselves in our bedrooms either. So how do we find something in between? And I think that's, again, I can't even believe saying this is political, but I think it's a good way to kind of, there's a good example to look at moving forward. And on that note, number two, I was in Miami, the last stop of my trip, and I got a tour of the stadium, which is going to open for fans, believe it or not, in a little over 2 weeks, with a college game. The University of Miami is going to play UAB, and 10 days after that, the Dolphins will play their home opener in week two in front of 13,000 fans. And I got to tell you, Gresh, the same thing that I just said about like this, what I just said about like the way that these teams and the league have handled training camp, you see it at work in the stadium. And I mean, the thing that was cool about it to me, and look, there's like, I could get into the nitty gritty of everything they did. It like the detail on it's ridiculous, right? Like the amount of people that they have, the amount of work that went into this, like the certifications they got for cleaning, the hospital grade air conditioning they have in the building, all of that is like, it's mind blowing the amount of work that went into it. I think what's interesting, what's cool about it though, is that, all right, like now we actually have a road back. You know what I mean? Now this is an actual real step back towards normalcy. And you know, the team president, Tom Garfinkel, said to me, he's like, yeah, a month ago, like I was a no. A month ago, I wouldn't have done this, you know? And like, but, you know, the numbers have gotten better, so we're going to give it a shot. The other thing I think that was interesting that he said was his message to the fans. Yeah, he had a message to the fans. Like, if you're not going to wear a mask, don't come. Like, we don't come. And you'll never hear NFL people say that, you know, like that sort of thing, like turning away paying right. customers. But he's like, but we don't want you here because if we have, you know, 6,000 of the 13,000 fans in the stands not wearing masks, you know, like we're going to have no fans at the next game. like simple as that.
Yeah. I think in certain parts of our country right now, using football as weaponry to get people to wear a mask is something that is actively going on and is being promoted by football coaches. We've heard about it in the South at the SEC, and they had their coaches put out a big social media blitz and all that stuff. You know, it's interesting because we live in a part of the country where right now, I don't think we could ever envision people going in stands to watch a football game. Yet in other parts of the country, it's a very viable possibility. But here's the thing. If the team is going to assume the risk of opening the doors, then quite honestly, Bert, they have to say stuff like that because yeah. they have to. They're, it's just, here's the line. You can't cross it. I went to a NASCAR race in New Hampshire about a month ago mm-hmm. where they did the appropriate social distancing. Bert, there was one time where I got a little itchy, sketchy, weird about it. And that was the whole scanning process of getting in where you kind of had everybody spread apart, but it was in such a small area that you really couldn't. Otherwise, when you have such a smaller crowd, you're able to kind of handle the flow. And then once you get to your seat, if you're appropriately social distanced, you then can then take the mask off to be able to cheer. And that's what they've done at NASCAR races. So I do think that there are some sports out there that maybe the NFL is at least able to look at their model, how they handled things.
Yeah.
If you've ever been on a NASCAR track, they're massive, massive facilities. There's lots of different ways people can get in. In the NFL, you can lock a bunch of gates and keep people out. Sometimes there's fences around these buildings. But it'll be interesting to see because, you know, the one thing we have learned in all of this is that our greatest enemy might be other humans. Because right. it's very unnatural for people to listen to the first thing they are told or to listen in general.
Yeah. What was it like? Did it feel fake?
No. You know what, dude? It's interesting because...
So that would qualify you. Like, would you want to go to a football game right now with 13,000 fans? Would it be worth it to go or would the experience be better on TV?
No, I'd go. I'd go because A, I know how to handle myself in terms of having hand sanitizer and all that kind of stuff and having masks and taking precautions. You know, the other thing about NASCAR too is BYOB. You know what I mean? On the whole, you're probably getting something so you're not sliding down the stands. You know what I mean? Go down to get yourself something to eat because you're there kind of hanging out and drinking. But no, there was that one spot getting in and otherwise that was it. And quite honestly, you know, it was almost like we could throw a rock and it, that's what we had to do to kind of get to the next person based on how they had everyone social distance. It can happen if people comply. And in certain states, without calling them out in the South, we know that there's some of those issues.
Right. Right. I mean, I just think, like I said, like, and again, this kind of like this, this, the, it's just a good message for everybody. You need to, like if we want to have this stuff back, freaking follow the rules. Like, right. Like just follow, like it's on all of us. And that's why, like, it drove me crazy to see the people in Kansas City that weren't wearing masks in the stands. Like, dude, do you understand? Like, this is a test.
Yeah.
This is a, like, you are not like just going there to hang out and you're not proving anything to anybody by not wearing a mask. You are being tested by the NFL right now. You are being tested by the Chiefs right now. And if you show that you can't handle it, you're not going to be back in there. So
no. And you're, and to your point, there, I'm sure there was a little bit of that. Hey, can we let these people in and do they have the ability to follow at least a little bit of rules right now that probably wouldn't be as strict as they are on game day? And to your point, you're finding out that even everywhere, people just don't want to comply. And maybe that's got to be the line. Like, you're not walking in the facility until we know you have one. And you can't escort everybody to their seats, though. That's the, you know, that's the other part of it. And then you're going to have fans yelling at fans. I didn't see any of that. But yeah, then again, we also ran to our seats because we had a, you know, we were all liquored up and ready to go. So, you know, I don't know if it's a complete apples to apples comparison.
Last point there. The Dolphins are going to shut off alcohol sales at noon. Right? Not at noon, at halftime, for that very reason.
Yeah, because
people,
you're right.
People might be a little less willing to comply after a few. All right, takeaway number three, Earl Thomas is now a free agent. And over the weekend, I actually happened to be in Baltimore when some of this was going down, but he got into a fight with Chuck Clark in practice. Basically, the team's leadership council spoke with John Harbaugh about it. The leadership council basically said, if you guys want to let him go, we're good with that, let him go. And then that was the death knell for Earl Thomas when the players said they were okay with letting him go. I mean, look, like, this is, to me, it's like, I think public perception hasn't caught up with who Earl Thomas is. And that's not to say he's like the worst guy on planet Earth. He's a weird guy. He marches to the beat of his own drummer. And forever, like, he had Cam Chancellor and Richard Sherman in Seattle keeping him in check. Once those guys walked out the door, once Cam Chancellor retired and once Richard Sherman went to San Francisco, you started to see things go a little sideways with Earl in Seattle. And now I think you've seen kind of the rest of the picture. And this is going to be a tough situation for Earl Thomas because, like, Baltimore's one of those places, man, where when you get kicked out of there, like, I think it's sort of – it leads to some arched eyebrows across the league.
Of course it does. And, you know, all I got to do is a quick Google search to throw in Earl Thomas domestic. And you could see that there's that issue hanging over him, which right nowadays in the NFL, no one wants to touch, no matter how good the player is. So I guess the old advice for Earl Thomas is, see if you can examine why in the world you got an organization that seemingly loved you to unlove you pretty quickly, and that there were players that were willing to push you off that proverbial cliff as well. And then for Earl Thomas, he's got to get the life in order outside of football. But we know that sometimes necessity can be the mother of invention, meaning that maybe, just maybe, someone, some coach has got to hold his nose and go, okay, I know that this Earl Thomas, I might not love him, but I'm going to bring him in because you have no other choice if you're trying to win a championship. And that's where the old rubber will meet the road in terms of this guy getting a second chance in the league, because he has some stuff, stains on the resume, let's call it, that most teams would say, nah, I don't want to deal with this dude.
Well, and that's why the context of how you're of the context in which you're signing him is relevant here, And that's how coaches will talk themselves into it. A coach will have a need. Maybe they get to a week and a half out of the season. Somebody goes down in their secondary. Maybe the young free safety hits a roadblock in his development. And the coach will say, well, we're not buying him at $14 million a year. We're buying him at like maybe a non-guaranteed $2 million. Mm-hmm. And if I buy low on him, you know what? I can get rid of him at any time. And if he's not making much money, well, then, you know, how much power is he going to have in a locker room where he doesn't know anybody? So, you know, that's how I think somebody winds up talking themselves into it. It's going to be an interesting, like, legal fight there, too, with whether or not the Ravens wind up owing him the $10 million, which was fully guaranteed. I do think the kind of comical part about this is whatever legs his argument had, he might have kind of shot himself in the foot on that one when he posted the practice video, because there was some he said, she said going on with the Chuck Clark thing. And I don't know if there's audio that the Ravens have there, you know, like maybe there is, and maybe you can tell what happened, but there's probably some gray area there. I'm pretty sure that, you know, the idea of posting practice video and a fight that happened on practice on social media probably falls under the heading of conduct detrimental.
Yeah, and you know that these organizations have got all the different ways written down, or at least legally, all the different ways that they would pursue situations like that. Now, here's the thing with Earl Thomas, and maybe you hit the nail on the head from the very beginning and we didn't realize it in terms of bringing it back around. Maybe it's a team who has veteran leadership who doesn't allow Earl Thomas to walk in and do some of the stuff that he did in Baltimore. And to where your point,
like where he's like number 10 in the pecking order. Instead
yeah.
Of
if he's, if, yeah. Like, it, you know, it, he would, I don't think he would walk into New England or Pittsburgh or Indianapolis or some of those places and be able to take over the locker room or get away with his level of shenanigans.
Pittsburgh would be interesting.
Him and Minkah Fitzpatrick now.
Pittsburgh would be interesting. Because then you can move Minkah around a little bit more.
And I think there are plenty of players on that football team who would be able to police that attitude, including the head coach. But to your point on the whole setting the tone, walking in the door, that's where the head coach can control it.
And then you'd have like the whole revenge factor too for him.
Oh, look, with all these guys, Rodney Harrison has been making up BS before games since 2003. Yeah,
but you get kicked out by the Ravens and you go to the Steelers. That's not bad.
Yeah, but I mean, good. It doesn't. There's always a tale of woe that bring a tear to a glass eye with a lot of these guys.
All right, fourth takeaway. The rookie quarterbacks, I think it's fascinating across the NFL, but I think what we're seeing now is proof of what I think you and I talked about probably in the spring, which was I think teams were probably forced to make a decision on whether or not they were going to play their rookie at quarterback, I'd say before camp even started. I'd say because you only have 4 weeks, you have no preseason games. On top of that, I think to be fair to the other 10 guys in the huddle, you have to start to build an offense for them. And it's hard to do that if you don't know who the quarterback's going to be, unless you have two guys that are just very, very similar. So we had three quarterbacks go in the first round in April. Joe Burrow was basically named starter. Zach Taylor didn't come out and say it, but he was basically named the starter the minute he got drafted there. So they've built everything through April and May and June, and then into training camp, into making Joe Burrow the starting quarterback against the Chargers week one on September 13th. The other two teams, I mean, I'll tell you, I was in Miami. Like, Ryan Fitzpatrick's the starting quarterback there. And I talked to Anthony Lynn about the Chargers situation.
Whoa.
Tyrod Taylor's the starting quarterback there. Like, and I think in both those situations, you have I think for both Flores and for Lynn in those situations, I think it was this guy is going to have to come get this job because we have to get ready for the season. And so, to be fair to the other 10 guys in the huddle, we've got to let these guys out there with the ones, and we got to build an offense around them. And you know what? If the young guy comes along and just blows us away, we'll adjust. But just to be fair to everybody, we've got to start to build a plan, and it's easier to do that with our veteran right now.
you know, we touched earlier on the whole thought process of coaches, right, in the very beginning, and how they can, to use a wrestling phrase, work themselves into a shoot, right? There's nothing there, but they get themselves all fired up. This COVID-19 in this kind of year, Bert, becomes the year where everybody can slow play their quarterback situation. Mm-hmm. Normally, if there was camp and competition and preseason games and able to judge, then the thoughts of people outside of the organization would be very different. And now the fans aren't going to hoot on you for a couple of weeks if you play the veteran quarterback and you're not good. Then it'll be the cries of, okay, put the young guy in and see what you have. I from a fan and a media standpoint, the psychology is fascinating to me, because it's almost like COVID-19 allows these coaches to sort of double down on those kind of thought processes that automatically get into their head as well. I can't trust him, and we can't put him through this, and we can't put him through that. How in the world can I put him out on the field when he might be the most talented guy, but you just don't trust to start a year sight unseen with no preseason games, not having that veteran with the hands on the wheel to start.
So, all right, let's just play a game with this. Over under on week that Tua starts his first game.
Five.
Okay.
Hold on. And wait. You're asking me to set the. I would say it's. If I were setting the line, I would say by week five, will Tua be the starter?
Okay. Justin Herbert?
Ooh. I would say week eight. Because that feels like it's going to get to the middle of the season before they would maybe pull the plug on Tyrod Taylor. And these are independent of injuries. These are, if everyone's healthy, what sort of spot on the calendar or on the schedule should we be looking at for maybe some of these guys to come in? And I would say with the Chargers, they got a much better chance than Miami this year in terms of success as a team. So I'd move back to like week eight.
And that's why, like, I think that's why I think the number's higher with Justin Herbert, like, as far as weeks, like, it's because the Chargers, I think, have a better chance to hang in the competition and to be there, you know, when we get to October and November. If you look at it, like, and I've run all of this over the last few years. If you look at it, the only quarterbacks that had true red shirts, and this is going back to, so the game, really the paradigm changed here in 2008 when Matt Ryan and Joe Flacco came out. Those guys both started very early as rookies, both advanced to the playoffs. Flacco got the Ravens to the AFC Championship game. Since then, Gresh, only two, I would say two true red shirts, right? And you can't even like make any correlation to the effect it had on their development, because one was Patrick Holmes. That obviously worked. The other was Jake Locker. That didn't work.
Right.
But what do those teams have in common? They were both contenders. They were both in it to the end. And I think that's it. You know, like they both, you know, the Titans had Matt Hasselbeck, the Chiefs had Alex Smith. So they both had answers at the position and they both contended. And so I think, you know, what most often happens is these quarterbacks go to bad teams. And if they're not starting from week one, the team falls out of contention. And then all of a sudden it becomes, well, why don't we just see what we have and get them reps and all the rest of it. So
do you remember how weird it was when Carson Palmer got redshirted that first year in Cincinnati, that he was the number one pick and had to play behind John Kitna for a year?
Yeah, and that's a thing of the past now, right?
Yeah, very much so.
I mean, you remember that. Like, that was – and Carson Palmer was coming out of USC, pro-style offense, playing for Norm Chow. Like, he was as ready – like a big kid. Like, it's not like he had to put on weight or anything else. He was ready to go. And that, like, Carson Palmer, that situation in 2020, Carson Palmer's probably starting a hell of a lot earlier than he did. So I think we'll probably see both Herbert and Tua before the end of the year. I think it's all going to depend on how long those teams remain in the race. Finally, takeaway number five, good on the Lions. I know Matt Patricia's been a little bit of a punching bag over the last couple of years. I think he's handled this beautifully. He handled the situation this spring really, really well. They had an open forum with their players. What I really respected about what they did in the spring was that they didn't come out with a public statement before they talked to their players. like they didn't, they weren't in a rush to like answer the, they weren't in a rush to answer the mob, you know, like, well, why haven't the Lions said anything? Why, like, no, the Lions were sitting down and talking with their players first. And then, you know, they kind of like processed everything and came out with a response as a group. And, you know, I think this is another example of Patricia kind of handing the baton to his players. And, you know, the Lions, for those, I don't think I even said the Lions, for those who haven't seen it, canceled practice on Tuesday in the aftermath of the shooting of Jacob Blake in Wisconsin. So I think, yeah, like that they did a fantastic, I think the Lions did a really nice job of letting the players take the lead on this. And then, you know, the players, obviously, I think the idea of a football coach canceling practice, you know, in the grand scheme of things, isn't the biggest thing in the world, but giving up a training camp practice is a big deal in these buildings.
It's huge.
So I think the idea of a coach letting the players make a decision on that, like that's something that's going to resonate across the football world.
No doubt. This is huge because it's a football coach who's thinking about something other than football, which normally at this time of year doesn't happen. And for Matt Patricia to do the stop down and to go with his players to those protests, considering, you know, they're not in the backyard of Detroit, but it's the whole close enough to where they really felt it was a genuine response. And that's where you have leadership on your football team and the football coach that's made some mistakes. And Bird, I think you make a very good point on the whole communicating with your players. We've seen in college, you know, Mike Norvell left Memphis and went to Florida State. And he was like, yeah, I've communicated with the players. And then 10 minutes later, a player calls him out. The next thing you know, you have an unnecessary issue on your hands that you created. You know, there are other ways to be able to pass on that football intel. Bert, in all honesty, and this, some are going to take this the wrong way, but I'm trying to think from the football coach standpoint, it's the whole, okay, what would I get out of this other than being known as a good human being? You know what you're doing, quite honestly? Team building.
Yeah.
That, in the mind of a football coach, that is, I think, how they will conceptualize what they're doing and it being so out of the box and not having practice and going out and reacting to what is going on in the world. And if the team is together with it, then yeah, in the mind of the football coach, hey, man, we didn't have practice today, but we had us a team building day.
You know, it's simple, too. Just he has our back. Right.
Like there's a lot of that. You're right.
It's that simple. And like how huge that is in the sport of football, where literally your safety, your health can ride on the job that the guy next to you is doing or the job the coach is doing for you. The idea that the people that you are working with have your back is huge in the sport. And you're right, Gresh. I mean, I think to some degree, this is Matt showing the players that he has their back.
Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see what happens moving forward in situations like this, especially during a regular season. If God forbid we have an instance of this happening, and maybe that's really the way we should look at it, is hope to God we don't have another one of these instances that happened in Wisconsin.
Yeah, let's hope that I guess based on the history of all of this, there may not be a whole lot of reason to be hopeful that it's the last one, but I think we're all on board with that.
It's disheartening to not have faith in humanity.
Yeah.
And think of what we talked about, this situation, how different it was for an NFL team to cancel practice, and how trying to get a minimal amount of people to wear a mask to go in a building to watch a football game has to turn into some statement from a football coach because people do or don't want to listen. Well, again, we're our own worst enemy. And by the way, to bring it back around, that's what the NFL is banking on, is that those 1,700 players who make these rosters aren't the enemy in terms of COVID-19 and going out and getting it and hopefully being able to just kind of do what a lot of people are doing right now, go to work and go home right now in these times, and maybe the NFL can sort of get through this.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Gresh, good to have you back. Good to have
yes, friend.
After a week off.
You were in DeSantisville. Go get that COVID test now.
I actually am going to get a COVID test this morning. Not even joking. I didn't know. I guess CVS, you can get them at CVS now.
Yeah, you can. There's places
there's a drive-through test. So I don't know how quickly I'll get my results back, but just put it this way. I think I made some family members nervous being in Florida. So just to kind of.
Oh, yeah. I would assume there might be one that was pretty insistent on when you came back and getting checked out.
I'll tell you what. I actually slept on the couch last night. And it wasn't because I was in the doghouse. It was because let's just take little precautions to make sure that the old governor down there didn't put the family in a bad spot.
We all work for someone that just happens to be in our house who tells you where to go when you get back in after that 7 p.m. after you land at 11 o'clock at night in Logan.
It's my reacclimation process. Gresh, appreciate you coming out. And we'll get to our special guest right after this. All right, well, now we're going to bring in a guy who I go a little ways back with and who is one of the more respected guys on the scouting side in the NFL. And I know like a lot of fans aren't familiar with a ton of these names on that side, but it's, you know, there are a lot of great people on that side of the business and a lot of people on that side of the business who are going to have their worlds and already have had their worlds turned upside down, but are going to continue to have their worlds turned upside down for at least the next year or so. So to talk about all of that, we're bringing in former Titans college scouting director, and I guess I'm going to call you an entrepreneur now, Blake. He just started Bettingfield Sports, so he's doing football consulting as well. He's Blake Bettingfield. Welcome in, Blake.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Albert.
All right. So, I know you've looked at some of the protocols now, and for those who haven't seen it, the scouting world is going to look different in the fall. So there are going to be no school calls. You're going to be allowed to go to games, to college games, to scout guys, but you know that's going to be kind of a school by school call whether or not they let scouts go in. And on top of that, you're only going to be able to do your advanced scouting, I believe, a week out. So you're not going to be able to get multiple looks at different teams that you might be playing. And that's added to the fact that there's no preseason game. So all the stuff that happens on the waiver wire, there's going to be a little bit more of a guessing game going on there because you got players getting cut that literally all the information that the teams have on those guys is going to be off their college tape and from their college scouts. And so, yeah, I guess Blake, where I want to start with you is what do you think the biggest adjustment is right now going on in a lot of these scouting departments and with general managers and directors and those sorts of people?
You know, I think if you take it from really two different sides of the scouting process, the pro side is really going to be affected by the fact that what you mentioned, no preseason games. The film evaluation on a lot of these players in camp will be done just based solely on their college film, and they really have no NFL film, so to speak, to look at. Really, the competition thing you're looking for when you're a pro scout and you're trying to evaluate pro players is really seeing them compete against players like them. Now you have to go back to the college film and evaluate players based on who they're playing against. Are they playing against other pros? And that's tough. You know, I think it's going to be also tough for the player standpoint. Those players that usually had an opportunity in training camp to make their mark in a game, maybe not with the reps in practice, but actually make their mark in a third or fourth quarter and have a chance to make a team, that's really going to be effective. But the pro side of things is really going to be up in the air. A lot of the pro scouting departments right now would go out to preseason games and start to do their advanced work for the season, getting the two deeps together, getting a lot of the formations and different things that they're going to look at when they do an advanced report for the coaching staffs during the year. So not only the way they play, but the type systems that they're going to run, not only on the offensive and defensive side, but really an important part is the special teams. Who are going to be the core special teams players in week one and week two? That's how you have to start to match up when you're doing advanced work in the pro department. So there's going to be a lot of things means that they're going to be hitting the ground running on week one, but there's going to be a lot of players that are not going to be evaluated. I think you're going to see less transactions this year in terms of picking up players on practice squads. You're probably going to keep your own more than you're willing to go out and take a chance on a player that you didn't see until last fall. A lot of these teams weren't allowed to see teams or players work out in the spring as well. So the last view on a lot of these players is last fall during the season.
So do you think, like, so let's stay on the pro side for a second there. So you think it's going to be less? I was talking to Matt Rhule about this, and I thought it was interesting because we were talking about the similarities between college and pro and how he's like, you know, like being a college coach, having that experience is going to help. And, you know, I thought about the whole hours that you don't get preseason games. But the one thing he said that was sort of interesting was, he's like, your team is your team, like, this year, you know, and he said in college, that's the way it is. You know, you got your 85 on scholarship and that's what you're going forward with. There's no, like, this guy's going to be gone and I can replace that guy. You're working with what you're working with. And his whole point was that, like, you know, this year in the NFL, you got 53, you got a bigger practice squad. It's going to be 16 guys in the practice squad. That adds up to 69. So if you have 80 in camp, you're really talking about shaving 11 off the roster. And then you, like for the most part, you're just working with what you're working with. Do you
see? No question. And I think, you know, the teams that went out in free agency and really had a kind of a forward-thinking approach to free agency and signed a lot of veteran-type players going into training camp, whether it's veteran backups on one-year contracts, players that have played a significant amount of time, whether it's, you know, started some games or been core special teams players in the past. I think those are the teams that really had a forward-thinking going into this year, knowing that these rookie players, outside of maybe your top two round draft choices, are really not going to see the field very much. You haven't seen them in game settings. Outside of college games, you're not going to see them outside of a practice. And I think that's going to be different for coaches to trust a fourth or fifth round pick to be in your two deep. I would rather take a veteran and be in my two deep that you've actually seen on film, and they know what to do. So I think you're going to see a lot of that as well, where in the past maybe you saw a fourth or fifth round pick emerge during the season, especially the early portion of the season, because of what they were able to do in the preseason games. But I think you're right, and I think Matt Rhule is really going to be able to kind of walk right in from the college game and really implement what he did in college. And this is our team, this is what we have, these 69 players are basically the pool we're gonna pick from this year, and that's how we're gonna go moving forward.
If you're a college scout, then is it sort of on you to maybe speak up if there is a name that you're like, wow, he's available? You know what I mean? Like, is it going to be on, like, the, cause I'm thinking now of, like, the guy who, you know, like the undrafted free agent, or maybe even the seventh round pick who, like, gets cut, where, you know, maybe it's on the college scout now to raise his hand and say, that guy can play. Like, you should take a look at him. Do you think there's going to be a little bit more of that? Because I have heard that from some GMs that interplay is going to be there, where they are going to have to go to, like, their area scouts to try to figure out about certain guys.
You know, the really good scouting departments will work together, the pro and college departments. And what I mean by that is a lot of the directors of pro scouting will send a list of cuts or transactions to the area scouts for feedback. And for feedback of do you really like this player? They have access to the reports, but instead of diving into those reports, but really get into a kind of a one-liner on each player, get a little bit of a snippet so the pro director and the pro scouts can get a little bit of a heads up when a player is released. And what they'll do is they'll send those out to an email setting and ask for a little bit of a feedback to see if they need to go forward with claiming a player.
Okay. The college side's fascinating to me because I know you and I have talked about this in the past, but, you know, in a way, like, you know, your area scouts, they aren't just, like, evaluating football. They're almost like, you know, private investigators. You know what I mean? Like, out there, yes, on the road for you guys. And a lot of times I know those guys have, like, they'll have contacts with the local police department. They'll have contacts in the academic world, all of that. How do you think this changes the paradigm that you can't, like, because I know those guys are, like, this time of year, they would be at fall camp, right? Like, and it's a great time to get access to certain parts of the program that you might not be able to get during the season. And then getting to go see them practice in the fall, if things stay this way where that you can't go to practice and you can't, obviously like you're not going to be able to go to fall camp. Like, how do you think that impacts the job as a college scout?
Big time. It really does. You know, I think as a veteran scout, a scout will go on into a school setting and he will go through the protocols that the college team has for him. Meet with the pro liaison, maybe meet with a couple of position coaches that they allow. But what happens is during an entire day when you're scouting at a university, you get there when the coaches get there in the morning and you leave at the end of practice if they allow you to stay that late. So you're spending an entire work day from 6:37 in the morning to maybe 4:30 at 5 at night at one school looking at those players. During that time, you kind of go outside the protocol of just the pro liaison. All the contacts you've made at those schools, you're going to spend time with maybe a trainer, an athletic trainer, the head of security, the strength and conditioning coaches, the equipment guys, anybody, the secretaries, anybody to give you some information on players that you didn't acquire just from the standard list that the pro liaison gave you. When you're standing out at practice, it's a great time to mingle with other position coaches that maybe you couldn't catch during the day because they had meetings or they were visiting with players. So there's a lot of those things that you wait till practice time, get out to practice early to get an opportunity to talk to some of the position coaches. That's no longer on the table. That's going to be something that veteran scouts are going to have to use their contacts to be able to get on the phone with these people. And it's going to be a constant catch-up game. Instead of finishing a school in one day, now you're going to constantly backtrack yourself and wait for the phone call to come from an assistant coach or a recruiting director or a pro liaison. Or, you know, a lot of them are going to set up opportunities to zoom in and get the initial information. But that's just part of it. You know, I think the evaluation process for college scouts goes far beyond just the film, like you mentioned. You're part private eye, and meaning you've got to do your background on this player as a football player, as a what does he do in the meeting rooms, but also at academically, how is he, you know, in the classrooms? How does he deal with the other students at the university? These are going to be very important questions that are going to have to be answered, and you're going to be doing that over phone now. In game settings, it's very tough to get the coaches to loosen up. They're tight before games. You can go on the field and have a brief chat with a couple of assistant coaches, but you know those conversations are really short and more congratulatory and you know wishing them a good game type setting and just getting your face in front of them. But it's going to be tough this year for scouting departments. I think if you have a young, inexperienced scouting staff, it's going to be hard for someone to get a phone call back from an assistant coach if he doesn't know your name and face. And I think that's why some of the more veteran scouting staffs will really benefit this fall.
That's really interesting too, because I have heard about some of the Zoom calls the bigger schools are putting on, and what I'm getting is, well, you know, yeah, but there are 25 guys in that Zoom call, and maybe the trainer's on the Zoom or the academic advisor's on the Zoom, and like he doesn't know 15 of the 25 on the call. He's not going to spill like sensitive information in that setting. So you need to be able to like get that guy on the phone afterwards, or else you're not getting it.
Well, they're not going to spill sensitive information because they're afraid it's going to be taped as well. And you know,
that's right. Yeah. Because they're cognizant. That's a great point. They're cognizant. All you got to do is hit that little record button. Like we hit the record button on the Zoom here.
That's right. You know, you're in a one-on-one setting with a trainer. He's willing to kind of tell you not only the injury stuff is a little bit more sensitive with the HIPAA laws, but you know, he's willing to tell you how often they come in for treatment. Do they miss treatment? How do they treat the other student trainers around? You know, he's not going to do that on a Zoom call. He's not going to put that out there for people that he really doesn't know. And I think that's why the scouting world is so important to have veteran type scouts that have those connections. You know, when I first started in scouting, I didn't have that. I had to build those kind of that reputation, build those contacts up, and it became a little easier as I got older in the business. So I think young scouts could really struggle early on. And general managers at this time in the fall, they really don't have time to get on the phone and call colleges. They don't. And then you're also subject to, at the end of a college season, the upheaval of coaches getting fired or hired some at another school and trying to track them down with new phone numbers, new email addresses, that type of thing. So really, that's why that fall is so important. That condensed 4 or 5 months is so important, because once the season's over, coaches move. And, you know, maybe they're not willing to talk about the players that they just coached because they're onto a new team.
Okay, so say you have, like, and you were obviously in a supervisory position, so you were the one that was sort of telling guys what to do. Say they do allow scouts at games. What are you telling your area scout to get at Florida State, Clemson, or at Texas, Oklahoma, or whatever it is? Like, what are you telling your area scout to go in there and hone in on and get for you?
You know, I'll tell you what I would tell them to do. I would have them get there the day that the team arrives at the visiting hotel. And if that's going to be the setting, if they're going to go to a hotel, and I'm going to find the assistant coaches in the lobby of that hotel, and I'm going to have those one-on-ones there. Whether I take them to dinner or have a few drinks afterwards, I'm going to make sure I get some one-on-one time with those visiting coaches. I'm not sure how a lot of the teams are going to do it, you know, if they're going to have those hotel settings, but I'm going to make sure I'm around. I'm going to get that one-on-one time, especially at the big schools with a lot of players. You know, when you're talking about some of these schools like LSU or Alabama and Ohio State, you're talking about a high volume number of NFL caliber players that you're going to need information on. If you're talking about one or two players, maybe you can do it over a phone setting, and that's okay. But you really want to get that one-on-one time. So I would tell them in that game setting, get there early. You know, get there at the game as soon as you can. Text the coaches ahead of time to come out on the field and spend a little time with you in a one-on-one setting, not in a group setting, because in a group setting, the coach gets a little bit more uncomfortable. But I try to find out as much information on those as possible. You know where they're going to be. You know they're going to be in that hotel setting. You know they're not going to leave. And you try to go there and acquire as much information as possible.
And then during the game, like, I guess it's because I know practice access is important, right, for body types and stuff like that. So I guess during the game you'd be telling them, like, just size the guy up, get access to, like tell me what the guy looks like, you know. And I you know, it was interesting. I was talking to I think it was a college scouting director about this a couple of weeks ago. He said, like, well, you know, like, guys like Vic Beasley and Brian Burns, who we weren't sure, like, could they keep on weight? It was important to body type them in the fall because they come to the combine and they're all, you know, jacked up. It's like, do we know that they can play it that weight? So I guess during games it'd be like, kind of, how do they interact with teammates? Like, how do they, like, what do they look like physically? That sort of stuff.
You know, I think that's very important, and I think that touches on something that they're going to miss this year, is that August evaluation at practice. What happens is these players come in at a certain weight, and during those two-a-days, during the fall practices, they lose weight. And that's why it's so important, like a Vic Beasley, for example, who was a first-round pick and probably going to be a first-round pick, you know, early on before his junior year started. You wanted to see what he looked like in August and then compare it to what he looked like in a later setting in November, in later portion of the season. Was he able to maintain that weight? Did he lose a significant amount, and why did he lose it? Did he not maintain his nutrition and diet? Is he not an eater? Did he come in heavy to put on that weight that the coach required but couldn't maintain it? You know, those are things that he's going to have when he goes to the NFL as well. So, you know, I think that's important to have those comparables. But you're not going to have that this year. You know, when you go to a game setting, you are out there body typing players to see how they match up with NFL players. Do they look the part? What is a deficiency in their frame? Where can they add? These are all things that go into a scouting report. That's one of the main things. The other part of is how they play and interact during the game, not only on the field, on the sidelines. You know, are they engaged with the coaching staff? Are they engaged with their group? Are they sitting off to themselves and not responding to the other group? Those are all, that's why the eyeballs are always on you as a scout in a game setting, something you can't see on film, but something you can see in a live game. So, you know, those are things that you want to see. If there's any injuries that you've heard of, you can always tell in a warm-up setting, are they favoring an injury? And, you know, those are things you need to know as well.
Okay, so ultimately, how do you think that this is going to impact next year's draft class? You know, you have some kids who have already opted out, like Micah Parsons and Greg Rousseau and Caleb Farley. Like, so you've got the guys who've opted out. You have the conferences that aren't playing but might play in January. You got the conferences right now that are full steam ahead. And we don't know what chaos is to come, right? Like, we don't know what this is going to look like in 2 months. Like, right now, how would you say that this is going to affect the 2021 draft? And if you're a scout, how nervous are you about the way all this is playing out now, and your ability, I guess, to get clean evaluations on everybody that you need to see?
You know, I think you have to treat the players that have either opted out or just aren't having a season this year because their conference has decided to opt out. You have to treat them like an injured player, even though they're not injured. A lot of times you have a player that maybe played one game and was significantly injured, and that's the way you have to treat them. You have to go back to the previous year's film. But again, you want to see what those players are like a Micah Parsons, for example. You know, he's going to be a really good prospect in this upcoming draft. You would like to see him on field. What are the progressions he made during this last season? Not only on the way on the field, but in his body and in his frame. You know, has he continued to gain weight and hold it, maintain that strength that he's going to need in the NFL? But those are things that. Is there a player that emerges that takes his spot in the 2021 draft? I think that could be very important. I think you're going to see a trend this year in the draft that you're going to see a lot of players drafted based on the 2020 film, whether it's the ACC, Big 12, or SEC, but some of those other conferences that have decided to play at a lower level, you're going to see players get drafted late that have 2020 film instead of maybe a bigger school player that didn't play at all in 2020. The eyeball test is so important. The recent history of them playing, you know, when you scout, track record is a great indicator. And if you're not playing this year, you lose that in a lot of evaluators, especially GMs' minds. If you had a player that unfortunately was injured in 2019 and played just a small amount and either opted out or is not playing in 2020, he's even further behind.
And that's Rondale Moore from Purdue,
exactly.
Right? Yeah.
And he's even further behind because you want to see a player play healthy and you want to see him be able to finish a season that way. Other than, you know, he's going to get knocked down because of that. And he's a dynamic talent. But is he going to be able to hold up for a 16-game season in the NFL?
Right. So, yeah, I mean, like, it's just it's – it seems to me, too, like with a lot of these – I mean, it's just an impossible position for so many of these kids to be in. Like, how do you think you'd advise them right now? Like, if you're a kid in the Big Ten, would you advise them to play in January? If you're a kid who's a top 20 pick, would you advise them to go forward with the season? I mean, what's the best – and should a kid stay in school or should he drop out and start to prepare for the draft? I mean, what do you think the best advice for all of these kids is? I know they're all in different situations, but what do you think the best way you could advise these kids would be right now?
You know, I think and this is kind of self-serving when I say this, but, you know, I think if you're a top player and if your team decides to play in January, which I highly doubt that's going to happen, but if your team decides to play in January, you almost need to make it a deal with the university that you're going to play a couple of games to get film and you're going to opt out after that. It's unfortunate for a team setting and there's going to be a lot of, you know, bad press over it initially, but they need that film, whether they play early in January or February to get a couple of games under their belt to show what they have and then move on. And I'm talking about top players. I'm talking about first rounders, maybe a high second rounder, but you need to show that film. I think players that are in the middle portion of the draft or latter portion of the draft, play the whole season if you're playing in the spring. Mm-hmm. You know, what is it going to hurt you? It's only going to help you to increase your value. And you may be the only game in town in terms of just a couple of conferences playing in the spring. All eyes are going to be on you. You have an opportunity to really show late before the draft process to the scouts what you're worth. And maybe you can raise your game and raise your value. So, you know, I think those are going to be a case-by-case basis with a lot of these players. You don't want to put a player in harm's way that close to the draft because of the medical. But, you know, also you need that film as well.
Okay, so I do want, before we get you out of here, I do want to ask you about a specific a specific example that I think applies to what some teams are going through with rookie quarterbacks right now, in that you were in Tennessee when you guys drafted a quarterback in the first round in the lockout year. And that, I believe, and you know, me and Gresh got into this earlier, I believe that was one of two like real true red shirts over the last 12 years since Matt Ryan and Joe Flacco, where a team drafted a quarterback in the first round and really redshirted him for the whole year. Patrick Mahomes is the other example. So, like, what do you remember about that year drafting a quarterback into that environment, and like kind of how hard it made it on Jake in that situation, and how that might apply to a Joe Burrow or a Justin Herbert or a Tua Tagovailoa right now?
You know, I think our situation was very tough. We had a head coaching change in that setting as well, and it was a late head coaching change. Jeff Fisher left and Mike Munchak came in, and Coach Munchak was scrambling to find a staff because the decision was made to move on from Coach Fisher to Coach Munchak late in the process, and he was scrambling to find a staff. So not only were we going through the draft evaluation part, but he's trying to find out somebody to run his offense that he really wants. When Jake came in, you know, it was a situation where it was tough. You know, it's tough for a rookie quarterback not to be able to come in the building and spend time with his coaches. And that's tough for a lot of players, even the veteran players with this new staff that was coming on board. You know, I think when you have this setting where even a Justin Herbert or Tua, those live reps in preseason is so important just to get through some of the mistakes. Have your mistakes in those preseason games, not the first game of the year. The game speeds up in week one compared to the preseason. It really does. And I know players talk about it all the time, but when you have players that are veteran players that have been doing it for a long time, they hit the ground running in week one. Very, very seldom do they take 2 or 3 weeks to kind of get up to speed. That's usually the rookies or new players in a system. So those rookie quarterbacks are really going to, if they play week one, are really going to have some growing pains early in the season, unlike some of these other quarterbacks that have transitioned a little bit faster as a rookie.
Do you think, like, so I thought what was interesting was, like, the Bengals have basically made no bones about it, right? That Burrow is their starter. And the Chargers and the Dolphins have sort of gone the other direction, where they're giving like the first team reps to the veterans, to Tyrod and to Ryan Fitzpatrick. So, like, do you think it's like one of those things too, like where just to be fair to everybody, you have to make a decision earlier. Like, just to be fair to the other 10 guys in the huddle, like, you have to make a decision earlier because you have to build an offense, and you have to build an offense for everybody, not just for the quarterback, right? Like, so do you think there's some element of that too in what's going on now, where you know, the coaches sort of had to make their, like, kind of had to have a plan for all this to begin with, where it's all right, like, this is kind of what we're going forward with.
You know, I think so. And in both of those settings, they have players that have started games, whether it's Tyrod Taylor or Ryan Fitzpatrick. They have players that the other veteran players on the team have respect for and seen them in games, and they've had some success, you know, with different teams. So, you know, those are easier, I think, situations to put them in first, and then let the rookie ride while he's learning and continue to get reps. Maybe get reps in situations and games where they're not going to have in the preseason this year, but give them a couple of series here and there just to get their feet wet. I think with the Chargers, they're going to be looking to win this year, maybe where the Dolphins have a little bit more time to play with while they're continuing to rebuild.
So, like, I mean, it's interesting too, because you kind of like look at like the way it could play out over the year, where, and we said this earlier, it's just, it some of it comes down to like whether or not you're in the race, right? Like, so, right. You know, in the end, I mean, like, if, like you said, like, if the Chargers are contending all year, like you guys were that year in Tennessee, mm-hmm. like, there's no need for a change, or you don't want to rock the boat, you know, whereas when, you know, you're not as competitive, it's easy to kind of convince yourself, let's just throw the kid out there.
No question about it. And I think that's what the Bengals are looking, you know, at right now. Just go with Joe Burrow and, you know, put him in with hopefully that he has some veterans surrounding him, whether it's A.J. Green gets healthy and, you know, the offensive line should be solid enough to protect him. They have a running game, have a couple of runners that that can take some pressure off of him, and not everything is on his shoulders like sometimes a true number one pick overall will have. But the Dolphins are probably in the best situation where they can go and they can play Fitzpatrick until they get in certain game situations. And maybe they find an opponent early in the season where Tua can fit and be very effective early on, and they'll be able to take over from there.
And you were with Fitz in Tennessee. Are you surprised he's still playing?
You know, no, because I'll tell you the thing that about Fitzpatrick is as smart as he is, and he's a very smart guy, he plays the game very loose. And he's one of the more frustrating quarterbacks to watch when you're watching him on your team. And then he's very exciting at other times. He's unbelievable in the sense that, like, he can have a 3-touchdown game with no interceptions, or he can have a no-touchdown game with 3 interceptions. Yeah. You just never know which fits you're going to get. But he has that exciting kind of aura about him where you just never know what's going to click that day. But he makes plays at times. And, you know, he's really good with the team. And I think he'll be very good with Tua as well, you know, as Tua emerges and eventually takes over for it.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, it seems like he's been great with Tua. I don't know if you saw it, but Tua actually came to one of his press conferences wearing a Fitz jersey. So I guess they're getting along all right. Okay, he's Blake Bedingfield, former Titans college scouting director. Blake, why don't you tell everybody a little bit about what you're doing right now with Bedingfield Sports?
You know, I worked in the NFL for 19, 20 years and worked in a couple of the other leagues, the XFL, the AAF, and enjoyed that portion of it. But, you know, I started my own football consulting business. It's called BedingfieldSports.com. And what I work with a lot of NFL teams in terms of evaluations leading up to the draft, and work with a lot of NFL agents out there actually too, you know, evaluating players for them. And And I've started this company with the idea that, you know, I started working with a lot of colleges as well. With the recruiting departments becoming so big, they're really like an NFL scouting department. And what I do is I go out and I help the universities and colleges really set up their scouting staffs and learn to evaluate players, how to write reports, the proper way of going about it. I did that for a number of years in the NFL, and I'm able to share that. I've got a passion for scouting, a passion for evaluating players, and it's been a fun process. I've also started another part where I look at high school players as well. There were some local people here in town in Nashville that really were outstanding players but weren't getting offers from universities. And I have, you know, 20-plus years of dealing in with all the different universities and colleges and contacts there. And what I do is I call up my friends at all these different universities, and I put these players in front of them. And as I tell the players, I can't get you a scholarship. I can only put you in front of the people that that are doing the evaluations and can offer. And what I do is I help these players. Basically, I kind of promote them to the universities, and then they go and take it from there. I can use my contacts that way. It helps the university as well. I reached out to a number of my friends at different schools and said, is this something that is beneficial to you? And because of I have so many years evaluating in the NFL, and they said, Blake, anybody you give us, we're going to look at, because we know you know what you're looking at. So, you know, it's been a fun process. The high school thing, it was new to me when I started this, but I really enjoyed it. And I've helped a number of kids get scholarships, not only small school scholarships, but a lot of Power Five and top programs too, that once you get them on the list, once you get them looked at, the snowball effect happens for a lot of these players, and it's been fun to watch, and I like to see kids' dreams come true.
That's fantastic. By the way, like, I'm just wondering, what sort of feedback are you getting from your friends in the NFL scouting world right now about what it's like and how chaotic it is?
You know, it's so, I think early on in the summers, they were worried not only about what the landscape is going to look like, but, you know, their jobs. And I think that's so important. Scouts are sometimes the forgotten, the heroes of a team sometimes, because they're out there doing the day-to-day work on the road. And they're, we always say out of sight, out of mind as a scout, and the team kind of forgets about them. Well, in situations like this, where colleges were opting out or players were opting out, you know, there was either two ways to go. Either the scouts were not going to be very important because of a lack of schools, or they were going to be even more important because they really need those scouts with those contacts. And I think it's swayed from one side, the worry of not having that job when the fall comes around, to now they're even going to be more valuable for an NFL team. And the teams are seeing that right now, that especially some people with a lot of experience that can make phone calls and really go about their business. You really don't want to teach a brand new scout how to go on the road and evaluate players in this type setting. You want to have scouts that have done it, whether it's a year or 20 years, you want to have scouts that have been there and done that.
You know, and it's so interesting when you were saying like the experience thing. I don't know if you watched Hard Knocks last night, but it sort of came into focus, I think, where Anthony Lynn was addressing his players, and he said, like, other coaches are going to call me, and I'm going to tell them the truth. You know what I mean? Like, I thought it was so interesting because it kind of took you inside what you're talking about, which is, like, just the network of, like who you know. It's like, well, if I see my college scout tells me there's this guy the Chargers cut that he really liked coming out, and now I can get Anthony Lynn on the phone to ask him, and I know I'm going to get the truth, that becomes a super powerful thing in this setting. So it all kind of works together that way.
No question about it. The football business is one big fraternity. We just work for different teams. It's just one of 32 divisions of one big company. We all do the same job, and you never want to lead somebody down a path of giving bad information, because that reputation stays with you. So like an Anthony Lamb, what he's saying in that setting is so true. If the head coach from another team is looking for a player, he's going to pick up the phone and call and say, you know, how was he in your building? You know, what were the negatives? What were the positives? Not as much on the film type setting, but in
stuff
the building.
Stuff you can't see. Right. Absolutely. Okay. So important. Again, he's Blake Bedingfield, former college scouting director of the Tennessee Titans. You can follow him on Twitter at Blake Bed, I think, right? At Blake Bedd. And he's the owner of Bedingfield Sports. Appreciate you coming out, Blake.
Always happy to be with you, Albert.
All right. Thanks again to Blake. He was fantastic. A very experienced, connected voice in the scouting world. So I hope you guys took something from that, kind of giving you guys an inside look into how it's working inside NFL organizations right now. We're going to jump to your questions. You guys know how this works. Ever since COVID hit, we've gone back to the six-pack. The six-pack is what we've done since 2016. And that basically is every Tuesday we put the call out for questions on Twitter. I'll pick six. If I pick yours, you get a like. That means I hit that little heart thing on the Twitter machine, and you get an answer here. Question number one comes this week from Craig Ginsburg. That's at Craig Adam G. What would it take for Baker Mayfield to keep his job beyond this year? First-year GM, first-year coach that didn't draft him. Could the team move on next year if he underwhelms? Now, I think this question obviously is in play with all the third-year quarterbacks. It seems to me like year three is when teams have started to make harder decisions on players at that position. You saw it with Mitch Trubisky bringing in competition for him this year in Nick Foles. You know, after year three, on the flip side, the Rams gave Jared Goff a huge contract. The Eagles gave Carson Wentz a huge contract. So it seems like that's sort of become kind of a critical point for young quarterbacks. So Baker Mayfield, Josh Allen, Sam Darnold, all three of those guys are going into year three and coming out of year three. We'll probably look at them a little bit differently because that's the history. I think for Baker Mayfield to keep his job beyond this year, I think he will keep his job beyond this year, just to be clear on it. And I think to keep his job beyond this year, he's got to be a good soldier. He's got to be a good program guy. And I think he's got to show, again, that he's capable of continuing to take steps in his development. And what I've heard there, the stuff that I've heard, you know, internally in the building, he's more willing to be vocal in team meetings. That's a good thing.
He has shown a playmaking ability on the field. He's been up and down a little bit. He's shown a playmaking ability and ability to hit balls downfield. And he's shown an attention to detail with some of the things he's focused on specifically this offseason, one of them being his footwork out of the shotgun. And so I think you see good signs there. I think what you hope for if you're Kevin Stefanski, Alex Van Pelt, the guys who will be working with him, is that you're going to have a better player in December than you had in September. Question number two from Peter Johnson. That's at Peter Johnson, 930. Which teams do you think will most be affected by having fans or limited fans? I mean, no fans or limited fans, which may benefit? All right, Peter. So I think that the first thing I want to say when it comes to this, there's going to be inequities across the league. You know, Sean McDermott, who I love and who's done a great job in Buffalo, said that he doesn't think it's right. It probably isn't right. But here's the fact. The facts are the league is probably going to lose tens of millions of dollars, maybe up to $100 million per team this year. And they're going to do everything they can to try to get that money back. Everything that they can do to try to preserve any of the revenue that they're losing is a good thing for the players as well, because that's going to help mitigate the damage done to the salary cap, not just in 2021, but really over the couple of years after that as well. And so, you know, I think that the league, the players are going to be on board with doing whatever they can to try to preserve as much revenue as they possibly can, which is why this is happening, which is why there will be inequities across the league. As for teams that will be most affected by having no fans or limited fans, I think the teams that will be adversely affected are the ones that have a great home field advantage. Seattle's on that list. Kansas City's on that list. I think the Philadelphia Eagles would be another one that would be on that list. There are certain teams that have a great home field advantage as a result of the noise in their stadiums, the environment teams have to confront going into those places. And so I think those teams do lose a little something. Which teams could benefit? I've kind of thrown a curveball at this to answer this question a few times now. And if you haven't heard it, here it is. I think the teams that play in cold weather cities late in the year could have an advantage, because I think that there's it's just the idea of a team having to go into Buffalo or having to go into Green Bay, like for a night game in November or December, and you're going into a really uncomfortable environment to begin with, and then there's no juice like coming from the stands, and say you fall behind 10 to nothing, and now all of a sudden it's 10 degrees out, it's snowing sideways, like, and there's just no energy in the stadium. I mean, to me, I think that the cold weather teams, if this continues late into the year, could be the teams that benefit, because even when you're getting booed or heckled by a team, that's energy. So the idea of being in like a cold weather environment that maybe is just going to be uncomfortable to begin with, and now there's no energy in the stadium, I think it could give teams like a Buffalo, like a Green Bay, that play outside in these environments a distinct advantage. Question number three from Dusty. That's at Barstool. Dustin, chances the NFL finishes the season. Dustin, I'm going to give you the stock answer. It sort of depends on how we're doing in the country in November and December. I think the NFL's given itself the best chance possible, considering all the different factors in play, the best chance possible to get a full season played. Will the season finish? I just think that depends on how we're doing as a country. And so many of these outside factors that are going to be sort of like injected into the NFL bubble. And that's the spouses of players and coaches going back to work, the children of players and coaches going back to work. All of these things, you know, could introduce new factors into those ecosystems. And if you do that, you've got a lot less of a chance to, if that happens, you've got, you know, obviously a diminished chance of finishing the season. And so much of this is going to kind of ride on how we're doing as a country in November and December. But I think the NFL has given itself a fantastic shot at getting it done. Question number four from Graham Bailey. That's at Graham Bailey. Do you think the Browns land Earl Thomas or Earl Logan Ryan? This is obviously related to the injury situation the Cleveland Browns have on defense. Most recently, they lost Grant Delpit, a really promising young free safety. That's where Earl Thomas's name comes up. Graham, here's what I would tell you. First-year coach, I would say if you needed a corner, Logan Ryan, yes. If you need a safety, maybe Earl Thomas, no. That's a young roster. Earl Thomas would walk in there and have a lot of leverage in that situation to begin with. You know, and I look at it and I say, well, if things went wrong in Baltimore and that place is winning and there's a lot of positive there and that place has got a strong culture and they couldn't do it, then how are we going to pull it off with a group of people who are just getting started, right? Like, it's just getting started. And so I'd be worried about that if I was the Browns, just based on where they are from a building standpoint. The flip side, a Logan Ryan could be great for your building, could be great for you trying to build something. So I think some of those decisions, I know that wasn't why you asked that question, but I think some of those decisions will very much be marked by those sorts of things, as they should be. Question number five is from Christian's Plan. That's at Christian's Plan. How has Donovan Smith looked in camp? Donovan Smith's fine, and I don't think he's the question for the Bucs. Nor is Ali Marpet the question for the Bucs. Nor is Ryan Jensen the question for the Bucs. The question for the Bucs coming into camp were Alex Kappa, their young guard, and then the rookie right tackle Tristan Wirfs. And Tristan Wirfs, from what I understand, turned a corner about a week ago. Kappa's had a great camp, and really looks like, you know, he's grown into his body. You know, he was a Division II player coming out of college, I believe. So he's grown into his body. So you're seeing really good signs there. Those two guys are going to be so key. I know nobody's focusing on them, you know, as the Bucks get all this attention with Brady there and everything else. Keep an eye on those two guys. Those two guys could wind up being crucial to where the season goes. Smith's going to be fine, I think. Marpet's going to be fine. You know, Jensen's going to be fine. Those two guys, really, really important, as is the ability for the Bucks to maintain some semblance of depth on the offensive line. Need to protect that 43-year-old quarterback so he can get the ball out there to Mike Evans and Chris Godwin and Rob Gronkowski and Cam Brate and O.J. Howard and Ronald Jones and Scotty Miller and everybody else. Question number six, last question of the week. This is from Taylor Rourke. That's at Time Is After Us. What are your expectations for the Colts this year, and which of the rookies do you see making the biggest impact this season? Michael Pittman Jr. or Jonathan Taylor? You know, Taylor, I'm going to go with Jonathan Taylor. I think, I don't understand why he wasn't seen as the number one back in this draft class. I love what he brings to the table. Now, there is the question about catching the ball. The Wisconsin threw the ball to him some last year. He's worked a lot on that. And this is a guy who's built like, you know, your traditional bell cow, and he runs 4.3, and he rushed for 6,000 yards in 3 years of college. And you've got, he's playing behind Anthony Costanzo and Quentin Nelson and Ryan Kelly, and in an offense that is going to be looking to run the ball. And so I think Jonathan Taylor is the guy. I think Pittman will be fine. Receivers take a little bit longer to come along. I'd buy stock in Jonathan Taylor right now. Here's the other thing. I do think that the team is closer to being a very real contender, like a team that can advance in the playoffs than people are giving them credit for. You forget where they were before Luck retired last year. This was a team that is in a really good place from a building standpoint with young guys like Nelson, like Darius Leonard. They've continued to draft well. I think they're in a really good spot going forward. They've got a long-term quarterback question, and that's an important one. I think Rivers is going to be good this year. Buy stock in Taylor. I think the Colts are going to be right there with the Titans and the Texans competing in the AFC South. Appreciate you guys coming out. As always, we want your feedback. We love your feedback. We're going to incorporate your feedback. We're doing a little longer podcast now. I think this one's going to probably be, and Shelby will be able to answer this for me after the show, but an hour and 15, hour and 20. Appreciate the people who've made it all the way to the end, and we want to make this better. So if you want a shorter listen, let me know, and we'll make it more rapid fire. I'm just trying to give you guys the best football content I possibly can as we get closer to the season. You guys know where to find me on Twitter, at Albert Breer, on Facebook, at Albert R. Breer, on Instagram, at Albert_Breer. And always listen to all of our podcasts. You guys know we're all on one feed now, the MMQB NFL podcast feed. You go there, you get the Week in Review podcast, which incorporates all of us. You can get the Week Side podcast with Jenny and Connor. You can also get the Monday Morning podcast with Gary and Andy. All of them are good listens. I listen to all those in the car, not just my own. You guys, again, hit that subscribe button. You get all of those in one place. Same time next week. We'll see you guys then.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Want to keep your personal number private but still stay connected? With Line 2, you can get a second phone line right on your device with a super simple app and no need for another phone. Whether it's for online shopping, dating, or shielding your main number from spam, Line 2 is an easy way to manage it all. Ready for peace of mind without breaking the bank? Call, text, block, and more for only $9.99. Get started with line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in any app store today. Line 2, your second line simplified.